Well, please stay tuned for unique features or space and astronomy features, because this is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, we have all of the action from New Zealand as Australia's newest satellite is placed into low Earth orbit on the 50th anniversary of the Europa 1 F9 launch from Woomera.
Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, and you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Yes, there were a bunch of folks at the University of New South Wales in Canberra who were turning blue last Thursday afternoon. Atop an Electron rocket was a satellite they had built. Called M2 Pathfinder, it had been in New Zealand since March. Just days before launch, New Zealand went into COVID-19 lockdown and the Electron launch was postponed. Last week, with New Zealanders having survived the pandemic, work resumed on the Mahia Peninsula launch site and the Auckland Control Centre. Although there were high altitude winds, the Electron rocket was loaded with fuel and oxygen. The countdown proceeded. The launch window was due to open in the mid-afternoon and close not long after sunset. The Space Show followed all of the action.
Good evening and welcome to the live broadcast of Rocket Lab's 12th Electron launch, a small sat rideshare we've called Don't Stop Me Now. I'm Max Muncy, and we're coming to you live from Rocket Lab's Mission Control Center here in Auckland, New Zealand. Tonight's launch will take place from around 500 kilometers southeast of Auckland, down at Rocket Lab's Launch Complex 1 on the beautiful Mahia Peninsula. We are currently tracking some high wind for tonight's mission, but launch operations are in full swing as we continue the countdown to launch. Those of you who follow our launches will know that we were only days away from launching this mission in late March, when operations were paused in response to the global COVID-19 situation. Like countless other businesses, we paused our operations and stayed at home to do our part in preventing the spread of COVID-19. Our priority is, and always will be, the health and well-being of our team, our customers, families, and the communities in which we operate. A few weeks later, with restrictions now eased, we're back in the pad at LC-1. By quickly adapting the way we work, we've been able to maintain a state of launch readiness throughout the disruption. We've held on to our entire workforce and continued placing orders with our suppliers, many of them being small businesses across the U.S. and New Zealand. Our focus in recent years has been on developing technologies, facilities, and teams that enable us to build rockets in days, not months or years. With these systems now in place, we can produce an Electron every 18 days to meet our busy manifest for the rest of this year and well into 2021. We're incredibly proud of the way our team has adapted to new ways of working, and we're grateful for the steadfast support of our customers and suppliers throughout these times. The Electron launch vehicle is a three-stage liquid-fueled launch vehicle designed specifically for small satellite missions. To date, Electron has flown 48 commercial and government small satellites to space. Successful deployment of this mission will bring the total count to 53. The satellites on board this rideshare mission are safely encapsulated inside the rocket's nose cone structure, which is on the top and otherwise called the fairing. Now let's take a look at the customers and satellites on board today's mission. Don't Stop Me Now is a rideshare to low Earth orbit for NASA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the University of New South Wales Canberra Space. The spacecraft on board include NASA's Andesite satellite, which has been created by students and professors at Boston University to study the Earth's magnetic field as part of NASA's CubeSat launch initiative. There are also three payloads on board which are designed, built, and operated by the NRO. The mission was procured under the agency's Rapid Acquisition of a Small Rocket, or RAISR, contract vehicle, which allows the NRO to explore new launch opportunities that provide a streamlined commercial approach for getting small satellites into space. This mission follows Rocket Lab's first dedicated mission for the NRO, which was Birds of a Feather, and that was launched in January of this year. The final small sat onboard Electron is the M2 Pathfinder satellite. And this is a collaboration between the University of New South Wales Canberra Space and the Australian government, and that will test communications architecture and other technologies.
Twice the countdown approached T0, but each time was wound back in the hopes weather would clear. The last possible moment to launch the Electron was at 6:32 p.m. in New Zealand, that is 4:32 in Eastern Australia. As Charlie Duke said, we were a bunch of blokes turning blue as we approached T0 for the third time.
All stations, range is green, auto-sequence arm enabled.
Avionics flight mission.
Flight avionics.
Confirmed TVC battery charging is disabled.
Confirmed.
And avionics, please confirm stage 2 umbilical puff is nominal.
Confirmed.
Okay, all stations, flight on mission cord. From now on, there should be no red flags on your LCCs. And I can confirm the vehicle's green, ready for flight. VMS, flight on mission.
Go ahead.
Please confirm flight computer as goes are green.
Confirm.
And VMS, please lock auto sequence and confirm.
Confirmed.
All stations, flight on mission. We are currently go for auto sequence start at T-minus 2 minutes. Avionics flight mission.
Flight avionics.
Please confirm all AV bats have been switched to internal power.
Confirmed.
And avionics, please confirm stage power is disabled on all 3 stages.
External power is disabled.
All stations, be advised, vehicles now on internal power. PLS flight mission.
PLS copies.
Please begin lock skid reset.
Copy.
PLS flight on mission.
PLS copies.
Please disable anti-geysering and confirm.
Anti-geysering disabled.
Stage 1, please confirm stage 1 tanks are pressed.
Stage 1 is pressed.
Stage 2, same to you.
Stage 2 is pressed.
Hold, hold, hold. Ground wind exceedance.
Okay.
This is an update from Mission Control Auckland. The team has made the decision to stand down today due to high winds. We still have several days remaining in the launch window, so we hope to see you next time.
During the 2-day postponement, we had time to reflect on some of Rocket Lab's early history as described by Radio New Zealand.
The first space rocket to be launched from New Zealand soil is being readied for launch. The Atea 1 is due to be propelled into space from Great Mercury Island just off the Coromandel Peninsula in about an hour's time. Our reporter Matthew Farrell is at the launch site. I asked him what Mission Control Mercury Island is like.
It's a very new, very shiny garden shed cut into a hillside downwind of the launch site, which is a custom-made welded launch pad sitting on a little peak, looking out to sea. 82 degrees the rocket's pointed, 90 degrees straight up. Not the safest for a rocket launch, because obviously it's going to come straight back down again if it does end up leaving the launch pad. And everybody's going to be some distance off the rocket when the moment of truth comes.
So we're not talking about banks of computers and guys with horn-rimmed glasses and pocket protectors here.
Well, it's a pretty small garden shed. There's going to be four people in this shed for the launch. Some of the people who've waited the longest and had the most to do with this project getting to this stage are actually going to be the people who don't get to witness the moment that the rocket is powered up and asked to do its thing. They're not going to be able to see the rocket. They're only going to be able to see it on laptop screens. But there's a couple of laptops, and they're powered by a diesel generator. It's certainly a minimalist approach.
All right, the rocket itself, how big is it? What does it look like?
The rocket's 5 or 6 metres long. It'll weigh 60 kilograms is the launch mass, so the wet weight, so they say. The maximum diameter of it is 150 millimetres, so it's a lean, mean, and hopefully flying machine. The payload, the weight of the cargo it can take up is 2 kilograms, about 60 kilograms. And yet this thing's expected to reach Mach 5 in something like 15 seconds. I think it's doing 150 kilometres an hour before it leaves the launch pad area, and it's doing Mach 1 after 3 seconds. I think it's got some acceleration behind it.
So what is it going to do? Fly up into space and fall back down again?
Well, in rocket attempts, the Nikkel follows a suborbital parabolic trajectory, lofting up to 2 kilograms of payload to an altitude of 120 kilometers, then returning to Earth over the course of 10 to 20 minutes. What I mean is, whoosh, right in the air, and then a re-entry, a shoot inflation if all goes to plan, and a recovery out at sea. But as you can imagine, there's a huge potential area for this rocket to end up in a helicopter going up to look for it. But the airspace is closed off over some 130 square kilometres.
Much tension there this morning and, you know, the build-up to the launch?
Well, Peter Beck's incredibly cool about it. And last night he made an appeal which got everybody laughing. He said, and to the media gathered here, if this thing spuds it on the launch pad, please go easy on me. But he was saying, look, these kinds of launches, you know, in the nature of this industry, there are launch pad failures all the time, and they'd just try again on another suitable day.
That's our reporter on Great Mercury Island, Matthew Farrell. Conditions there reasonably clear and calm. Good news for the rocket launch. We will keep you briefed from Mission Control, even if it is a gun.
And that was the first time that an object had been launched into space, but not into orbit, from New Zealand. Well, Peter Beck went on from those early Aotea rocket tests on Great Mercury Island. For their much larger Electron rockets, he needed a much larger launch site. The Mahia Peninsula on the east coast of the North Island was chosen.
Mahia is a very remote place, a very special place. The community has really welcomed us here. A lot of the infrastructure here we had to build ourselves. We had to build 3.5 kilometres of road just to get to this specific site on the point.
Several years ago, Peter Beck spoke about the genesis of the Rocket Lab company.
My name's Peter Beck and I design, build and launch rockets into space. People in New Zealand often forget that we're a small country in the middle of nowhere and we've got an awful lot of satellite dishes pointing up to the sky and we're completely reliant on space infrastructure. Whether it be a telephone call to the United States or even just jumping on the internet, it's space infrastructure that enables all that to happen. I'll just briefly tell you a little bit about Rocket Lab and the whole point to Rocket Lab. So Rocket Lab is a small private company. We're actually the only private company in the Southern Hemisphere running a space launch program. And our laboratories are based within industrial research, and we're a completely private company, but we do enjoy sharing industrial research's laboratory facilities. And that's one of the other key differences with Rocket Lab is we're all about public access to space. So everyone in this room, if they wish, can go onto our website or give us a call and say, we want to send something into space, and as long as it's dead or not a mother-in-law, we're more than happy to send it into space. And that's a really exciting thing about the commercial space industry. The space is no longer governed by a whole lot of large governments and huge bureaucracy, and it really is the place for the privateer at the moment. And that's what Rocket Lab is definitely all about. Now, just quickly, how did we end up at Rocket Lab? You don't sort of wake up one morning and say, right, I'm going to build a rocket and go to space. Rocket Lab is essentially built on 13 years of my own private research. So, if you will, I'll just jump you back 13 years ago, and I was currently at that time working for a Fisher & Paykel down in Dunedin as an apprentice tool and die maker. And I decided one day, it was really the engineering challenge that first attracted me to building rockets, and also the dissatisfaction with internal combustion engines. There had to be a better way to produce power. So I did a whole lot of initial research, and that's one of the key fundamental things also that ethos is carried through to Rocket Lab today, and that's do a whole lot of research, understand the physics and the engineering, and then go and do something instead of just shooting from the hip. And that's the reason why I've got all my fingers and a full head of hair and not all charcoaled up, is because you can understand all the physics behind it before you start. So that's essentially what I did. And I decided to build a small hydrogen peroxide monopropellant thruster. And Fisher & Paykel at the time were incredibly supportive of my research and my activities. And many a time I'd go into the storeroom and say, hey, Trevor, I need a bit of titanium for my combustion chamber. Can you give us a quote from an engineering company and try and find some for me? And these pieces of titanium would just end up on my bench the next day or the next week, and I never received a quote for a piece of material yet. And they were just labelled job number apprentice project. And that was really fantastic support that Fisher & Paykel used to give me. And it paid off for them as well, because whether it's as the years went by and the rockets got more complicated, and I used more and more Fisher & Paykel's equipment and tools and analysis and everything like that, it paid off for them as well, because whether it's an injector for a rocket engine or an injector for an air brake for a dishwasher, it's the same thing. The physics are the same. So it was a complete waste of time. It was a good investment for Fisher & Paykel in the end. But anyway, after I built the small engine, it was time to make the fuel. Unfortunately, you can't just call up the phone and buy 90% proof hydrogen peroxide. The best you can do in New Zealand is 50% proof, and the rest of the percentage is all full of stabilisers that make it stable, which you don't want for rocket propulsion, and water and all sorts of other things. So even Fisher & Paykel drew the line at me commissioning a bubble reactor column and a pilot plant for manufacturing rocket fuel, so I had to take that one home. And unfortunately, I didn't have a workshop at home, but I did have a spare bedroom. So within that spare bedroom, I set up a small bubble reactor column pilot plant and started to produce my own hydrogen peroxide, and did so very successfully. And then once I achieved that goal, the next time was to scale up. Next thing to do was to scale up and make enough for rocket propulsion to actually make an engine and fire it as a test bed. So I moved my stuff outside essentially, and bought a garden shed, and really researched it thoroughly and did the best I could with the resources I had. Just little things like tying the shed down with wire ropes instead of bolting it to the ground, in case you have a massive explosion. You don't end up with your shed a couple of blocks away, you just end up a mess shed, you know, all on wire ropes. All those little things that are actually important. So I built this pilot plant in the hydrogen peroxide shed. And when I think back these days, it would just put a P-Lab to shame, it really would. There was oilless compressors running 24/7 and vents squirting and lights going all the time as I was producing this hydrogen peroxide. But anyway, cut a long story short, produced this hydrogen peroxide, and the research for the engine was very successful, and I did some novel research in liquid catalyst beds for the hydrogen peroxide, which is a little bit unusual. But anyway, I drew the line eventually at the hydrogen peroxide, because really I didn't have the facilities to undertake the research in a safe manner, and that's an important thing as well when you're mucking around with rockets. It's knowing when to pull the pin and knowing when to bail out, because you don't really get a second chance. And so anyway, what really crystallised for me was not having the safety equipment. And my chemical suit consisted of a whole lot of rubbish bags duct taped together, welding helmet, and lovely pink Madge dishwashing gloves for safety equipment. And it was in fact the pink Madge gloves that really let me down, because I got a small leak in it and got a little bit of hydrogen peroxide on my finger, and it's very, very oxidising and a wee chemical burn. And not a serious thing at all, but enough to give me a fright. And in fact, ran inside and into the sink and run cold water over this little burn. But the issue is, I still had a beaker of hydrogen peroxide in my other hand. And in my panic, I just tipped it down the sink, and I don't want to mess with this stuff anymore. Tipped it down the sink and carried on. I recommend to everybody here, if you have a beaker of 90% hydrogen peroxide in your hand, do not put it down your sink, because it causes some significant issues. And maybe there's a polymer chemist here who can tell me why, but it managed to melt every single PVC joint from my sink right down to the main pipe underneath the house.
We have more from New Zealand after these messages.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to The Space Show. Back in March, The Space Show spoke with Russell Boyce, the director of the University of New South Wales, Canberra, about the M2 Pathfinder satellite that at the time we spoke was just a day or so away from the expected launch.
The new satellite, it's about the size of a loaf of bread. It's a 3-unit CubeSat. This particular one, however, is almost 100% in-house designed, built, assembled, tested with the support of the people up on Mount Stromlo, and it will be operated by us as well completely. So it's a very, very exciting step for us and also for the country for space capability that is completely homegrown. This particular mission is a different activity that we're engaged in, and it's specifically aimed at building our own internal capability and in turn helping the way that we are able to provide space education, being a university group.
So what government departments are involved in this project?
That's not something that I'd like to discuss tonight.
Okay.
But I can confirm that it is the Australian government that is a supporter of this mission.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's been announced by other people as well. Right. So what are the main aims of the M2 Pathfinder?
Well, the name Pathfinder itself gives a bit of a hint. It's a prelude to a far more complicated mission that will be flying next year in 2021. So M2 Pathfinder, it's testing some particular subsystems that are required on that future mission in order for the success of that future activity. In particular, it's testing the software-defined radio that we've developed in-house. It's testing the ability of this spacecraft to be controllable in terms of its pointing. And it provides flight heritage for quite a large number of satellite components to do with the power supply, to do with onboard computing, and various other things.
Now, you said it's a 3U or a 3-unit CubeSat. Many people won't know what a CubeSat is and particularly what a 3-unit one is. Could you give us the size of it, please?
Absolutely. A CubeSat is a particular standardized version of what we call a nanosat. And the standard that it complies to, as the name suggests, it comes in cubic units. So a 1-unit or 1U CubeSat is 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters cubed. To get to 3 units, you stack 3 of those together. So 10 by 10 by 30, approximately. And it weighs several kilograms.
All right. And where was it built?
Well, it was built on our campus, which isn't completely true. It was fully designed on our campus. Some of the components were built elsewhere. For example, the aluminium structure was 3D printed in Melbourne. But for the most part, it was built and assembled in our clean room at UNSW Canberra at the Defence Force Academy, and then tested by our staff in collaboration with Australian National University people up at Mount Stromlo.
Now, when did you finish building it and testing it?
That's an interesting story. We essentially finished building it before Christmas, and given that we started this particular mission program in April of last year, the entire process from conception through to almost ready to fly took about 8 months. And our understanding is that there is only one other company or group in the world that has bettered that.
Now, what's the expected orbit of this satellite?
It's a sun-synchronous orbit, so that means almost polar, as in a north-south orientation. It will launch from New Zealand, heading out over the South Pacific, and our understanding is that we will be deployed from the rocket into orbit approximately an hour later, which will be somewhere up above the Arctic region.
Mm-hmm.
And so the satellite will then continue in, I was going to say endless, it's not endless because eventually it does deorbit, but a long cycle of laps of the Earth in a north-south direction while the Earth rotates underneath it.
Right. And will you be tracking it from just here in Australia, or will you have tracking facilities in other countries?
We have two methods of communicating with this spacecraft. There's a backup system where we can communicate essentially by text message from to and from the spacecraft via the Globalstar network in orbit. That's a backup so that if something goes wrong, we can obtain health checks from the satellite. The main communication method, though, is via the ground station that we have out near Yass, operated for us and indeed assembled for us by a very fine company there called Singulon, which does satellite communication ground station activities for quite a few customers. So I guess I can't emphasize enough, though, that it is completely homegrown technology, and it once we prove it in orbit, that puts not only our team, which is and has been for a long time the largest and most experienced space team in the country for missions, not only would put us in a fabulous position for ongoing activity, but also the country. So it's a very exciting step. And not just the hardware too, the flight software and the software on the ground for communicating with the satellite. We're slowly coming to understand that some of the things that our team have managed to create are not just world-class, but world-leading.
Well, thank you, Russell, for joining us on the Space Show. That's Russell Boyce, the director of the University of New South Wales Canberra Space Unit. Now, Russell and his team were well and truly turning blue on Saturday afternoon as the Rocket Lab team once more prepared the Electron for launch. Again, the Space Show followed all of the action.
Hello and welcome to the live broadcast of Rocket Lab's 12th Electron mission, Don't Stop Me Now. I'm Max Muncy and I'm coming to you live from Rocket Lab Mission Control. Thanks for joining us as we get ready to go to space once again. Earlier in the week, we stood down from a launch attempt for this mission due to high ground winds at Launch Complex 1. When it comes to launch, there are thousands of things within our control, but the weather simply is not one of them. We're back on the pad today, but we're still keeping an eye on weather conditions and are currently green for launch at T0. Earlier this week, it was high ground winds that caused us to stand down, and today we're tracking heavy cloud this time. At this stage, it's likely we could go into a planned hold at T-minus 12 minutes to wait for a gap in the weather for launch. Today's launch is taking place in Rocket Lab Launch Complex 1 on New Zealand's Mahia Peninsula, the world's only private orbital launch facility. From our inception, the mission has been to open access to space for small satellites, and key to that access is launch frequency. We designed and built a launch site that can support up to 120 missions per year to offer our customers unprecedented access to space.
Confirm AFTS is green and enabled for flight.
AFTS is green and enabled for flight.
Top clamp is open.
And proceed with Strongback retract for flight.
Retracting Strongback.
You're looking at our 12th Electron launch vehicle on the pad here at Launch Complex 1. The Electron rocket is a three-stage liquid-fueled launch vehicle designed specifically for small satellite missions. To date, Electron has flown 48 commercial and government small satellites to space. Successful deployment of today's payload will bring that total count to 53. In the past 3 years, Electron has become well acquainted with low Earth orbit, but in the coming months, we'll be venturing a little further, some 384,000 kilometers further. Early next year, Rocket Lab will launch a CubeSat into lunar orbit for NASA. This historic pathfinding mission supports NASA's Artemis program, which will land the first woman and next man on the moon by 2024. Using our Electron rocket and Photon lunar spacecraft, Rocket Lab will launch NASA's Capstone CubeSat into a unique lunar orbit. Capstone stands for Cislunar Autonomous Positioning System Technology Operations and Navigation Experiment. Capstone's primary objective is to test and verify the calculated orbital stability of a near-rectilinear halo orbit around the moon, which is the same orbit planned for the Lunar Gateway. The Gateway is a planned small space station that will orbit around the moon to provide astronauts access to the lunar surface. It will feature living quarters for astronauts, a lab for science and research, and ports for visiting spacecraft. Capstone will also test a navigation system that will measure its position relative to NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, without relying on ground stations. Capstone is one of the first steps to learn how to operate more robust missions in this orbit, and it's laying the groundwork for future exploration of our solar system. We are incredibly excited to be part of this historic mission, and we can't wait to share it with you. So as we continue through today's count, let me hand you over to the team in Mission Control to listen in on the final minutes before liftoff.
No stations. This is flight on mission code. From now on, there should be no red flags in your LCCs. And Be advised, vehicle is currently green, ready for flight. VMS, flight on mission.
Go ahead.
Please confirm flight computer as goes to green.
Confirm.
And VMS, please lock the auto sequence and confirm.
VMS is locked.
All stations flight on mission, I can confirm. We're go for auto sequence start at T-minus 2 minutes. Avionics, flight on mission code.
Flight avionics.
Please confirm all AV bats have been switched to internal power.
All AV bats are on internal power.
On the auto sequence.
Confirm stage power is disabled on all three stages.
External power is disabled.
All stations be advised, vehicle is now on internal power. PLS, flight on mission.
PLS copies.
PLS, please begin lot skid recirc.
Copy, beginning recirc.
PLS, flight on mission.
PLS copies.
Please disable anti-geysering and confirm.
Anti-geysering disabled.
Stage 1, confirm stage 1 tanks pressed.
Stage 1 is pressed.
Stage 2, confirm stage 2 tanks pressed.
Stage 2 is pressed.
Engine purge active. Deluge running.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Vehicle skip pad.
Stage 1 propulsion is nominal.
Vehicle is supersonic.
Well, after a brief hiatus, Electron is back in the skies heading to orbit. At T plus 35 seconds into flight, we're coming up to one of the first milestones of any mission to space, passing max Q. This is the point at which Electron will experience the highest amount of aerodynamic force on its way to orbit. Let's listen into the call from Mission Control.
Coming up on maximum dynamic pressure, pass through max Q.
Stage 1 propulsion is holding nominal. Stand by.
And there you have it. Electron has cleared max Q.
Entering burnout to tick mode.
AOS Chatham Station.
Coming up next is main engine cutoff, or MECO, which occurs when the 9 Rutherford engines shut down after exhausting their fuel reserves. Upon shutdown, the empty stage is jettisoned so that stage 2 can ignite and continue on its journey to low Earth orbit.
30 seconds remaining. Altitude is 50 kilometers. Speed is 1.6 kilometers per second. 10 seconds to staging.
MECO confirmed.
Stage 2 ignition confirmed.
That's the call we're looking for. We've had successful MECO, clean separation of Electron's first stage, and ignition of the vacuum-optimized Rutherford engine on Electron's second stage. We're approaching T plus 3 minutes into this mission with fairing separation coming
fairing
up next.
Fairing separation complete.
And there it is on your screen. The fairing has separated, clearing way for payload deployment, which occurs approximately 1 hour after liftoff.
Nominal.
For the next few minutes, you'll be hearing the word nominal quite a bit. The latest call was from Kevin Garcia, our Stage 2 operator. It's one of our favorite words at Rocket Lab, and it simply means everything is going as expected throughout the flight. On your left, you'll see a view of the operators in the Mission Control Room. These are the people you've been listening to throughout the broadcast on the Mission Control Net, and they're monitoring all things launch-related, from propulsion and telemetry data all the way through to our network traffic. We've heard plenty of updates from George Buchanan, our GNC operator today. The Rocket Lab GNC team are actively recruiting for senior roles in our Photon satellite program, so if you have a solid background in mathematics or physics, head to our career section at rocketlabusa.com for more info.
250 seconds remaining.
Stage 2 propulsion remains nominal.
Up next is the battery hot swap. This step is unique to Electron and its battery-powered pumps housed within the Rutherford engines. The pair of batteries that carried us thus far are nearing depletion, so to finish the job, we swap power over to a third fully charged battery. Let's wait for confirmation from Mission Control.
HVB battery discharge nominal. Approaching hot swap.
Throttling down.
Hot swap successful.
Battery jettison confirmed.
As you've just heard, we've had successful battery hot swap. Electron's trajectory continues to look nominal as we hit 6 minutes and 50 seconds into this mission.
Stage 2 propulsion holding nominal.
The next major milestone you'll hear is SECO, or second engine cutoff. This marks the end of the second stage burn, after which the kick stage will separate in preparation for payload deployment.
40 seconds remaining.
Engine burnout detect mode.
Guidance is in terminal. 15 seconds remaining.
SECO confirmed.
State separation confirmed.
And we're in a good transfer.
And there you have it. The kick stage is on its way to deliver the payloads to their individual orbits. For those of you who might be wondering what the kick stage is, here's a quick explanation of how this ingenious machine works to deploy payloads to orbit. Once the second stage takes us to an elliptical parking orbit, the kick stage separates and ignites its 3D printed Curie engine, circularizing the orbit. Using a cold gas reaction control system, the kick stage accurately orients itself to deploy each satellite to a specific orbit. Using this system, the kick stage is able to insert its payloads with precise orbits, even on rideshare missions with multiple satellites like this one. After deployment, the Curie engine reignites, propelling the kick stage to a lower orbit where it will be dragged into the Earth's atmosphere at a much faster rate, leaving behind nothing in orbit but our customer's satellites. Payload deployment is expected in the next hour or so, and we'll share confirmation on our Rocket Lab Twitter and Facebook accounts when we can. I'm Max Muncy, and until next time, this is Rocket Lab Mission Control signing off.
The satellites were released from the kick stage about 1 hour after launch. You can imagine the relief in Canberra when they picked up the first radio signals from their M2 Pathfinder satellite. As Charlie Duke said, we're breathing again. Australia's newest satellite has COSPAR name 2020-037E and is number 45,727 in the Spacetrack catalogue. However, the precise orbital parameters are classified, so I can't tell you when it's next coming over Melbourne, but as Russell said, it's in a polar orbit.